Coming up on this week's Book Show, New York Times columnist Gail Collins has written a new book on a subject that is timelier than ever, women and aging in America. Author of the acclaimed New York Times bestsellers When Everything Changed in America's Women, Collins was the first woman to serve as the editorial page editor of the New York Times. Her new book is No Stopping Us Now. Gail Collins on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. New York Times columnist Gail Collins has written a new book on a subject that is timelier than ever, women and aging in America. Author of the acclaimed New York Times bestsellers When Everything Changed in America's Women, Collins was the first woman to serve as the editorial page editor on the New York Times. Her new book is No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. She tells the inspiring story of women and aging throughout American history. She takes us from the colonies when a woman was considered marriageable, if civil, and under 50 years of age, through a long stretch when they were quietly retired to a rocking chair once they had passed their reproductive years, to 68-year-old Hillary Rodham Clinton accepting the Democratic presidential nomination. Gail Collins' new book is No Stopping Us Now, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to this particular subject of ultimately looking at these adventures?
Well, it was thinking back to the colonial women that you mentioned, the idea when you were a colonial woman in America, you didn't get old. I mean, because you created so much wealth and value, and that's one of the reasons men were so desperate to have you around. The colonial housewife, which was pretty much everybody, did gardening and created candles and butter and had chickens and eggs and had this entire parallel economy going on with the other housewives. And nobody talked about them in particular as getting old because what younger women wanted to come and learn from them. They were a central part of every household. They were valued throughout their lives as long as they were up and working. And then once people moved to the cities, suddenly for the middle-class woman, there was nothing to do. You had no real jobs. And all you did was to have children. And then once you passed childbearing age, you were done. It was all over. You were in a rocking chair, metaphorically and often really for the rest of your life. And then things changed again. And that's the sort of the parallels that I keep looking at here. Why did things change at different times? How did women make use of their age in different periods? And I really had a blast writing it, I have to tell you.
Well, just by the title of calling these adventures makes it seem like it's a blast, that it's fun.
Yeah, and just watching these women think about stuff. One of my favorite things in people in the book is Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who everybody knows as a fighter for women's rights. But in her earlier career, she was, and everybody, the women's cause before the Civil War was abolition. That was a particularly women's cause. And you weren't supposed to go out and speak about it or do anything in public because if you got up, you were stoned as a harlot because women just didn't do things like that. They were, you know, not thought about that way. And she figured out, if I go as a grandmother, I can get away with all this stuff. And she would walk on and basically with her gray hair and looking kind of dowdy and speaking as a grandmother and talking about her children and the home and everything else. And then she'd whap right into abolition and women's suffrage. And it worked for her. And she could go anywhere. She traveled in trains overnight, playing cards with the soldiers, and went up mountains, had all these adventures. And other women watching her started suggesting they should be writing odes to menopause, because that's when you really got liberated to do stuff.
Do those changes, in the sense of when something had been going on for a long time and then it gets change, what do those changes have in common, do you think, of looking at them in the totality of this book, what those moments have in common?
Well, if there's one sort of sweeping thought that I would have about women and aging, is that the difference between the way people regarded men aging, which was often, oh, what a distinguished gentleman this is, at a time when it's, oh, this used up lady, what's going on there? The difference was that men created wealth and women didn't. The colonial women created wealth, but you went through this long period where women didn't create wealth. And then we moved again toward a period, certainly where we're at right now, where women have the same opportunities, or at least many women have the opportunities that men have, to go out, to have careers, to create wealth on their own. And suddenly, miraculously, they're regarded in the same way that men are as they age.
And yet equal pay is still an issue. There's still issues. It's not like it's been solved.
No, nothing ever gets solved. And there's still issues, and there are also issues about age discrimination for both men and women. But if you look at the trajectory of it, and, you know, I've written, as you said, three books now on women's history in America. And the thing that which makes it impossible for me to be really discouraged and depressed about the course of things ever is that I live through a period in which women totally recreated their role in Western civilization. Nothing like that ever happened before. And I got to see it. I got to experience that moment when women joined society on an equal playing field with men. And of course, there are all these problems and you have to continue fighting forever. But the basic thought that when, for instance, a new young father gets his little baby, he never says anymore, oh no, it's a girl, I needed a boy to go on with family business or whatever. That doesn't really happen much at all anymore. And that's a historical, mind-breaking transformation. And women who are my age right now, we got to see that. So I cannot be pessimistic in general.
Leslie Stahl, in reviewing your book, said, reading this book, you realize that you can scratch history any patch and you'll find a pattern of women's heft and sway, wealth and authority rising and falling depending on demographics, politics, and the estate of the economy. Any time in history, you find that.
It's true. And if you look at the time of American history, in particular like the last century, you just see these decades. And during World War II, desperately needed women to do stuff because men were off fighting. Suddenly you'd get all of these stories in the magazines about how there's nothing customers like more than to see a 70-year-old woman carrying a tray of dishes in the restaurant with a twinkle in her eye, because that's what they needed them to do. So suddenly it was very cool for women to go out and work and do pretty much anything, to be a riveter. And they celebrated, there was a famous story celebrating, I think it was an 88-year-old riveter who was making planes, and how wonderful that was. And that was fantastic. And then the war is over suddenly, and times come in where there's a lot more competition for jobs, and suddenly older women are not nearly as popular. And then things come and go and come and go. And now, as I said, that when young women are moving up, I mean, the expectation is that they will do things the same way that men do. I will never forget in the 1980s, I was going around working on, I think, When Everything Changed, one of the other books anyway, and I was up at a college in Connecticut, a state college, and I had for some reason this whole room full of boys, and I was talking with them about what they wanted in a wife. And, you know, they weren't going to say with me there that they wanted somebody who was very attractive, but they said, you know, oh, personality is good. And then somebody said, and a good earner. And all the other guys went, yes, they have to be a good earner. And that's the transformation that we've experienced. It was partly because after World War II, you had this huge economic jump, and suddenly people expected and hoped to be able to be in the middle class, to have their own home, to send their kids to college, all these things that were very elite before the war. And that went on for a while, and it was great. And then other countries came back into the equation. There was more competition. The economy fell. There was the oil boycott. And suddenly, there just wasn't enough money to support a family in the style to which everybody had come to expect on one income. Suddenly, everybody's eyes turned toward the wife. And okay, good earner, get out there, let's do stuff. Young women growing up at that period suddenly realized they needed to train not just to find a man, but to find a good career. And that was the transformation.
Gail Collins is the author of the new book, No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. The book is published by Little Brown. The book, the way it is told, is in a chronological order. You look at a timeline, really, of bringing us from the colonies to the future.
Yeah, and there were good periods and bad periods if you happen to be older. There were some you would much rather not be in than others. Although I have to say, there was nothing but progress when it came to things like teeth. I tell you how tough the tooth thing was, for men too. But they found, I remember, the remains of a woman from Jamestown, the early colony, who was in her 30s, and she had 5 teeth. And that's sort of the way it was until dentistry really got going, which was much later than you would think. Women just lost their teeth. Well, men did too, but you didn't care that much about men because they didn't have to be attractive in the same way.
You talk about in the early 1900s, it's older women who led the fight for suffrage and ultimately gained some economic strength as consumers and workers and earning their own money.
Yeah, and it was easier, as I said, for older women to lead the fight for suffrage because they had a little more flexibility when it came to being out in the public era. And also, they could say very easily, okay, I've had my children, I did it, I raised them, I'm a grandma now, I've got, you know, I'm ready, I can go out. Whereas if younger women tried to do that stuff, they were often thought of as either being A, a harlot, or B, somebody who was neglecting her children at home. So women, older women, were the leaders of the suffrage movement for, you know, perfectly reasonable reasons, but they certainly stepped up.
Then you look at the 20s, and youth is glorified. It is the roaring 20s and the age of the flapper and the jazz age. So then, do you lose ground at that point?
Well, it wasn't the greatest age possible to be older. The costumes of the day, I think I thought in the book that, you know, the vision of what you should be right in the 1920s was, if you're a woman, you should either be 19, looking like you were 19, or just out of the picture completely. That was the only 3 options you had available because the whole culture was so into that kind of thing. And the clothing changed. I can't remember now how many, it was something like went from 17 to 3 pounds of clothing per woman every, you know, whenever she went out the door.
And when you see, talk of clothing, and we would see that again in the 60s, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, the 30s came along after the 20s, and suddenly Eleanor Roosevelt was the hero of the world coming along there. And you knew right then that, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt was not going to be a vision of, you know, youthful attractiveness, but she just knocked everybody dead. She had more energy than anybody in the world. She drove around the country all by herself. It drove the Secret Service crazy. So they taught her how to shoot a pistol so she could at least carry a gun while she was out there. She traveled to see the troops during the war, all, you know, in the South Pacific. She was just unstoppable. And, you know, she was one of those people who, like, when they're very young, they look like they're middle-aged. And then when they're very old, they look like they're middle-aged. And
and
it works out over the long run really, really well.
So often, as we talk about the change in anything, it's 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. And it brings to my mind of whatever the cause is, it always has to be a fight. It seems like we see this in the way you're telling the story, of course, in every decade, that there is a fight. I guess my question being, if you've won one, why can't it propel it to be a greater victory instead of just setting up the next fight?
Well, it is always. I mean, you look at the changes out there. Oh, my Lord in heaven. And you do step. Of course, you take, you know, 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, or 1 step back. But you've got that step. And then you're going to do it again and again and again. And then suddenly you turn around and you're me and you look back and you say, holy cow, what a transformation. And it's true particularly in the area of gender, of all the big transformations. I think that's possibly the one that there's been. But there's still, of course, there's discrimination. There are a lot of problems with working women and sexual harassment. And you deal with them as they come along. But then you look back and you think, wow, we cannot be discouraged about this.
When I mentioned in the introduction about your accomplishments at the New York Times, becoming the first woman to serve as the editorial page editor, how did you look on that at the time?
Well, the one thing I'd like to point out, because I always want, when I ever get a chance to say this, the first generation of women who fought this battle for equal rights and equal opportunity on the workplace, who filed all the suits back in the 60s, who led the fight in all the newsrooms, all the other rooms, they weren't the ones generally who got the benefits because they had driven everybody crazy and gotten in everybody's face. And so what happened was that they won the battle, but the people who got the benefits were people like me who walked in the door afterwards. So the generation of women, for instance, at the New York Times who fought the battle for equal opportunity at the paper were not the ones who got the really good jobs. It was people like me who came in after them. And the thing, my definition of a great heart is when you see something that you've always wanted for yourself and you fight hard so that somebody else can get it. You're not angry. You're happy to see that it's happened. And so many of those women who fought those battles at the Times in places like the Times for equal opportunity, who I know, were so happy when I got to be the editorial page editor. And I did not get any sense of any of them saying, that was supposed to be me. I could have done that. Why does this one get it and not me? It was just this great. And walking around the building once they announced that I was getting the job, everybody was sort of happy, and it wasn't about me in particular. Everybody just sort of liked the idea that this could happen.
But you did far more than just walk through the door. I mean, you had your own battles. It may not have been that particular battle, but you had your own battles.
Yeah, I had different, I mean, I did different things. The way I got started was I began in Connecticut. I couldn't find a job, actually. We got out of college, so I went to all these little bitty weeny papers around the state and said, I will cover your state representative for you for $10 a week or something. And we built up this business with my partner, Trish Hall, who became the op-ed editor at the Times later on. And we had all these little baby clients. We had about 40 papers. And I was writing, because they each wanted different stories, I was writing like 6 or 8 stories every day. And it was a great adventure. I learned so much, but it also kind of broke all the barriers for me between writing and talking or thinking. It's sort of like ice skating again. Once you get to a certain point, you don't think about just getting across the rink anymore. You think about doing little tricks. And so for me, writing has always been a stupendous pleasure. Every place I've worked has been kind of remarkable, I've got to say.
Your time, I mean, now as an op-ed columnist, how do you feel that as you watch the world go by, that of where we are now, we look at the periods we've talked about just in our conversation, and I certainly understand your point of looking back and saying, wow, we've come a long way. But where we are right now, are we in a good point for older women?
Well, it's not, I would say, for older women in general, in relation to the rest of society, it's probably better than it's ever been. And it could certainly go a long way further. There's still a lot of discrimination. And there's a lot of discrimination against older people and the economy in general. You know, and right now, politically, we're in a very traumatic period. And I never thought I'd see anything quite like this in my lifetime. But having been through all the stuff I've been through, I've got faith that we're going to charge ahead, get past this.
Didn't you just say it, though? I mean, that when I read a column, I like reading your column because, as you just said, of all the stuff I've seen, I want someone who's seen that stuff, who can connect those dots.
Well, thank you. That's great. I have to tell you also, when I was couple of papers. One was with the Daily News, I think, in the New York Daily News. I was covering the city government, and every column I would write, I would be just, oh, no, oh, my God, look what they did today. Oh, my Lord, it's getting worse and worse. And after a while, I thought, you know, I don't want to have people get up and read what I've written and then throw themselves out a window. I want to find some way to write about this stuff that will let people know what's happening and help them to think about it, but that won't make them sad or suicidally angry. And so that's what I try to do with my column. And, it's a real pleasure.
No Stopping Us Now is the name of the new book. Gail Collins is the author. It seems most journalists find this to be a very challenging time. And as you just said, for your column, I assume that is still a challenge, that it's hard not to to have that moment of saying, oh my God, now what?
That is so very, very true. But and I have to say, that since we've been going through this again with the administration, the work of the hard news journalists is just so spectacular. When I was editorial page editor, I always used to say that if there was anything that the news side needed, they should take it away from us if in the opinion side, if they had to, because the news gathering side is so central and crucial to what the Times is, what all great papers are, what most news gathering is all about. And the people at the Times who are right now covering this administration, I just knock me out completely and make me feel very hopeful about the future.
Do you ever have a thought of, oh, God, you know, I wish I was, it would still be so much fun to be the head of that editorial page?
No, I did it for 5 years, and it was wonderful. I had the best time, and I saw how the paper worked, which just knocked me out. It's so fantastic. And after about 5 years, I felt like, wow, this has been a great adventure, and now I should let somebody else do it, and I should move on. I can't exactly explain why, and Arthur Sulzberger, who was the publisher, that told me that nobody else had ever suggested that would be a good plan. Let's just take my great job and give it to somebody else. But I was just so grateful to have that experience. But I have to tell you, to be a columnist for the New York Times is possibly the best job in the entire universe.
Absolutely. Do you understand of how you, I guess, how much you think about this? Is it natural, or do you think about bringing the humor to a situation and understanding where that comes from? And is that natural, or is that something you have to dig for?
Well, as I've gone on long and long, as I said, that became my sort of plan as, even before I got to the Times, that if you used humor to describe things that were very difficult, it might make it easier for people to pick on them and go along. And so, yeah, I mean, it was definitely purposeful. And one of the periods that people keep mentioning to me all the time, when Mitt Romney was running for president, he certainly, we know now, was not the worst candidate ever running for president, but he was kind of boring. It was kind of hard to find fascinating things to say every day. So I learned at some point in time, his kids used to tell the story to tell how well organized he was about how they'd been driving to Canada, and the dog was in a crate in the top of the car in the roof, and
right.
It got sick, and then it was soiling the back window, and the kids were yelling, so Romney drove off into a stop that was not one of the designated planned pit stops and grabbed a hose and hosed down the dog and then jumped back in the car and drove off without letting anybody else out. And that was to show how well organized he was. But all I could think of was he drove to Canada with a dog on the roof of the car. And so for a while, it was sort of a joke to me and a sort of trick that every time, because I had nothing else to say, it was so thrilling about Mitt Romney, who once drove to Canada with a dog on the roof of the car. And it became a kind of a thing. And it's weird to me now that at least once every day I get a letter from some reader saying, what about Mitt and the dog on the roof of the car? Why can't we get back there again?
I was reading your column just a few weeks ago about Rudy Giuliani. And, you know, sometimes it just seems to me that the humor is just there, right? I mean, you at one point you just write the transcript and that serves as it works on its own, doesn't it?
Yeah. And when you've known these guys for so long and, you know, so many of these people are from New York City now, it's sort of embarrassing. You have all these stories left over from, There's the famous one that, you know, when Rudy was mayor, he suddenly called a press conference and announced he'd separated from his wife, and he had not mentioned it to his wife beforehand. That always seemed to me to be a moment of change with Rudy Giuliani.
I heard you speak at a book expo event about this book, and you were talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's sort of a wonderful example of what you're talking about in this book, isn't it?
Yeah, and you've got this woman, you know, who is in her late 80s, you know, moving forward, now planning to be there until she's 90, she says. And not only is and no one saying, oh, my gosh, she's really way too old to be doing this job. Every time you see a picture of her like doing push-ups in the gym or something, the entire world cheers. Oh, my, yes, go, Ruth. I mean, it is a good example of kind of, and the thing about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, by the way, that really knocks me out is not only that she goes to the gym and that she maintains shape after all of her health problems and that she's a very influential justice on the Supreme Court, but when she's not doing that, she goes around and gives talks and meets people. She's just the most unstoppable human being I have ever seen. That just knocks me out.
We are seeing the question of age for president be an issue on both for both men and women. And interestingly, the Elizabeth Warren is the youngest of the three candidates in their 70s.
Isn't it interesting? You've got three candidates in their 70s running for president, and the woman is the one that nobody talks about being in her 70s. I see very little discussion of, oh, my God, is she too old to be president? You know, a lot of other criticisms of Elizabeth Warren, but it's the two guys that everybody focuses on. And although they're a little bit older, it's still, that's just another earth-shaking moment, I think.
Well, because she doesn't, well, first of all, doesn't seem 70. She just has the energy comes out and you don't even think about age.
She is a little bumblebee, I'll tell you.
Right. No. it doesn't even occur to you, really.
Yeah. But she's 70 years old. I mean, you know.
So let me ask the question, whether it's male or female, should age enter into it, do you think, for voters?
I think it's fair to think about age. My own theory, in fact, I was conversing with Brett Stevens, another columnist who I have this little back and forth with once every other week. We were talking about that. I always think that people, whoever they are, male or female, tend to become more like themselves as they get older. And the things that you noticed earlier on are more so. Elizabeth Warren was always energetic, but wow. And she's grown so much as a candidate. She is so much more affable and approachable and able to merge her political smartness and her economic theories in with a really personable approach. She's grown during this period in a really amazing way. Joe Biden seems to me to be more like Joe Biden than ever. And Joe Biden was always sort of a really nice guy who was hard to kind of imagine running everything.
Mm.
He's still that sort of slightly vague, but, this is just me. I wouldn't want to put this on the entire world. And Bernie Sanders is bouncing around out there, but you're kind of scared, like, whoa, Bernie, hold on there, stop. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think that age is the central question there, but it's interesting that you've got, first of all, those people on the very top, and then you've got Pete Buttigieg running around saying, hey, 37, 37, come on now, I'm 37. So it goes on both sides.
The name of the new book is No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. The book is published by Little Brown. Gail Collins, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org and can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.